Okay, so I guess we will go ahead and begin. Good afternoon or evening, everybody, or morning, as the case may be. I'm Peter Klein, and as you may have heard, or as Bob Murphy may have mentioned at the beginning of the course, and as hopefully you know from recent emails, Bob is unavailable this week and asked me to give a guest lecture for him, in particular to discuss some of these issues related to factor pricing, Chapter 7 of Man, Economy, and State. I have had the privilege of teaching a few of you in other Mises Academy courses that I've done, and I haven't seen the complete class roster. I hope that I've met some of you before at Mises University or at the Rothbard Graduate Seminar or some other conference or event. And it's a real pleasure for me to be the understudy for the esteemed Professor Murphy. It's true that, you know, I don't have the beautiful hair that Murphy has. I'm not, you know, quite as charming or witty or clever as he is. And as one of the smart Alex in the chat window has already pointed out, I am not wearing a tie. But at least I am wearing a shirt. Now, as to what I'm wearing below the waist, that's something for only me and my closest friends to know. But anyway, it is a real pleasure to talk about Man, Economy, and State, one of the great classic works, of course, in the Austrian tradition, a book that is extremely substantive and often technical, but yet easy to read, and really provides a thorough grounding in almost every aspect of Austrian economic theory. So I know that you guys have covered in the three previous lectures the first few chapters of the production section, and this is about the middle of the production section in Man, Economy, and State. In fact, I think I have a little bit of a table of contents here. Whoops, I pressed the wrong button. Here we go. So just to remind you a little bit about why we're even doing this course, I'm sure that Bob has already given you a good sort of some background on why this is important and why we're doing it and so on. But, you know, Man, Economy, and State is a thick book. I think I have a couple of different editions of it here. You know, here's one hardback, one hard copy edition. This is a single volume edition. Somewhere else, I don't see it now, I have a two volume set. It's a weighty book. In this edition, there's including the index, it's 1,441 pages. So that's the two volumes of Man, Economy, and State, plus the third volume, Power and Market, which was originally supposed to be part of Man, Economy, and State, but when the book was published in the 1960s, the Power and Market chapters were omitted and were only published several years later as a separate book. So this is a big book. But even in this big book, Rothbard devotes a surprisingly large chunk to some issues that you might think are kind of boring, right? A lot of people are interested in Austrian economics because they want to learn about the free market. They're committed libertarians or anarcho-capitalists. They want to understand what's wrong with particular kinds of regulations. They want to study public policy. They're interested in the history of economic thought and a lot of kind of sort of exciting or even sexy, fashionable topics within economics. And Rothbard does cover many of those, but the bulk of Man, Economy, and State is what I've called in a recent article mundane economics. The word mundane here meaning ordinary, plain, nondescript, important, but sort of everyday stuff, right? So all this discussion in this course about production and pricing of factors and profits and so on, you know, that isn't maybe the sexiest stuff, but it is really at the core. It's at the heart of Man, Economy, and State. Right, these five chapters in particular, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, that's the heart of this section in Rothbard's textbook, the structure of production, how interest is determined, and the role of interest in the production process, which of course is critically important for Austrians, though not so important for mainstream economists, because Austrians emphasize that the production process takes place through time, right? It's a temporal story. And anytime you have humans acting through time, we must take time preference into account. And that's why interest is a fundamental part of our production theory. By the way, those of you who have taken mainstream courses, mainstream neoclassical economics courses, I'll talk a little bit about some of those issues in a few minutes here. You would never find the theory of the firm, the theory of production, and any kind of temporal interest or money issues treated together, right? Production theory or price theory is part of the microeconomics textbook, the micro course. You might have a macroeconomics course somewhere else where they talk about interest and time and business cycles and money and so on. But that would be a completely separate thing. It wouldn't be integrated in any way with the production material. But here, of course, Rothbard does it in a different way. The Austrians consider production and money and time and interest all to be part of one integrated story. So then there's actually two chapters on factor pricing. The one I'm going to talk about today, chapter 7, and then a later chapter, chapter 9, which revisits some of the issues we'll talk about today in a little bit more detail. And then sandwiched between 7 and 9 is a really terrific chapter on entrepreneurship. Why is all this important? And again, I'm giving you some background here to repeat some of the things that Bob has already said, but just since you have the chance to hear it from me, from a different person instead of your regular instructor, it's sometimes good to hear the same ideas presented from a couple of different perspectives, Murphy's wimpy perspective and my totally awesome perspective. No, I don't mean that. I mean just to get a slightly different point of view, sometimes you can learn a little bit of additional insight. Let me do a brief detour. Some of you may know the history of the book Man, Economy, and State, and I don't know if Bob talked about this already, but originally Rothbard set out to write a much smaller book. It was going to be kind of a companion to Mises' Human Action, a slightly watered down or easier to read, simplified version of Human Action for beginners, a textbook based on Human Action, because as you know, if you've ever read or tried to read Human Action, it is a very difficult book. It's a very advanced book. Mises assumes that the reader knows, of course, not only Greek and Latin and German and French and Italian and so on, but also the reader is steeped in philosophy, that the reader knows all of the Austrian classics, Menger and von Bawerk and so on, not to mention the German historical school, etc. Human Action demands a lot from the reader, and so Rothbard had the idea, and some of his colleagues back in the 1950s had the idea that it would be valuable to produce a simplified version. If you look at Rothbard's correspondence and the memos that he wrote in the many years it took him to write Man, Economy, and State, as he sat down to write it, he realized that Mises had left a lot of things out. Not that these things were missing from Mises' worldview somehow, but that Mises skipped over a lot of stuff. He assumed that the reader already knew the basics of price theory from the Austrian tradition, the basics of production theory, and so on. And so Mises would just kind of casually mention things in passing and offer some critique and analysis and talk about common fallacies and so on, and then go right on with the next thing without actually filling in all of the steps for the reader, for the novice reader, for the non-expert reader, which of course all of us would be. The step-by-step, incremental, systematic, block upon block presentation of production theory that you get in Man, Economy, and State is really a Rothbardian innovation. This is not in the other great works of Austrian economics. Menger, of course, lays out the basic concepts of production theory. Menger introduced the notions of orders of goods, right? Higher order goods, meaning more remote from consumption, and lower order goods, meaning those that are actually consumed, right? The bread is a lower order good. The flour that is used to make the bread is at a higher stage of production. The wheat and the grinding machines and so on, milling machines that are used to make the flour are a higher stage of production yet. And the tractors and the implements and the pesticides and so on that are used to make the wheat are at a higher order of production still. Right? This idea of a structure of production with different stages from higher order goods to lower order goods. This is discussed by Menger, but Menger doesn't explain the principles of pricing of the higher order goods in any great detail. He kind of hints at it, but he doesn't spell it out. He doesn't explain exactly what determines the different ways that inputs, factors of production will be combined to produce higher order goods. He doesn't go through all the details. Baumbaberg adds many particular insights about these issues, but treats them in a kind of scattershot way, a little bit here, a little bit there. Mises only tangentially addresses these issues. There is really isn't a whole lot of production theory in Human Action compared to other things that are in Human Action. And I might add, just as an aside, that in some of contemporary Austrian economics, where the emphasis is placed on spontaneous order and institutions and the knowledge problem and so on, applied anarchism, etc., there isn't a whole lot of attention paid there to these kind of more basic or fundamental issues of production theory and price theory. And I think maybe it's because it's assumed that this is just ordinary stuff that's in all the mainstream textbooks too. There's nothing particularly Austrian about it. But one of the things that I hope taking this course will convince you is that the Austrians really do have a theory of production that is important, that's distinct from neoclassical or mainstream production theory, that has something to offer to us today, and that is worth your time. Okay. Now, the basic kind of background concept that underlies the analysis in Chapter 7 is the so-called theory of imputation. Imputation is a word that was coined by Beezer, one of Menger's students and successors, but the basic idea is explained pretty well in Menger's principles. The definition of imputation is the idea that the value of these higher order goods, the value of factors of production, is driven by, determined by, or imputed from the values that consumers place on final goods and services. In other words, why does flour have value? Because consumers value bread, they get utility from consuming bread, they're willing to pay money for bread, and therefore bread makers are willing to purchase flour along with other ingredients, ovens and yeast and water and sugar and salt and so on, to use them for making bread. Why is flour, what determines the value of the things that are used to make flour, the wheat? Well, the value of that wheat is determined by the value of the flour. And then the value of the tractors is determined by the value of the wheat and so on. Great example here in Menger, this sort of a lengthy quotation, it's on page 65 of Menger's Principles. You don't have to read through the whole thing now, but let me explain the high points. It's Menger's discussion of tobacco. He says, if, as the result of a change in taste, the need for tobacco should disappear completely. Now, what Menger means by need, of course, is simply the subjective valuation of consumers. He doesn't mean need in any kind of medical sense or psychological sense or something like that. Certainly not in an ethical sense, although he probably, I assume that Menger was a smoker and probably thought tobacco was great. If, as a result of the change in taste, the need for tobacco should disappear completely, the first consequence would be that all stocks of finished tobacco products on hand would be deprived of their goods character. Now, what Mises means by something having goods character means that it is a good or service that is desired by consumers because consumers subjectively perceive that consuming this good will make them better off, right? They can achieve some utility, they can satisfy an end or an objective by the possession and control of this particular good. So if all of a sudden, you know, the demand for tobacco should completely disappear, well then cigars and cigarettes and so on, would these would no longer be economic goods. They would not have any value to consumers. They wouldn't be bought and sold in markets. Menger goes on, a further consequence would be that the raw tobacco leaves, the machines, tools, and implements applicable exclusively to the processing of tobacco, okay, so stuff that can only be used to make tobacco, the specialized labor services employed in the production of tobacco products, the available stocks of tobacco seeds, et cetera, would lose their goods character as well. Okay, so if you've got a cigarette rolling machine, it doesn't have any alternate use except to make cigarettes. If the demand for tobacco should totally disappear, well, then that cigarette rolling machine will also no longer have any economic value. The services presently so well paid of the agents who have so much skill in the grading and merchandising of tobaccos in such places as Cuba, Manila, Puerto Rico, and Havana, but Menger really did know a lot about tobacco, as well as the specialized labor services, many people, and so on and so forth, these would cease to be economic goods as well. Tobacco boxes, humidors, tobacco pipes, pipe stems, etc., would lose their goods character to the extent that, as someone is pointing out, that they are specific factors, meaning to the extent that they can only be used to produce tobacco products that are no longer desired. I mean, you know, school children often use those little pipe cleaners to make for, you know, for crafts, to make little projects in school and so on. So to the extent that any of these things, tobacco boxes and pipe stems, et cetera, can be used for something else, they would still have some value in those alternate uses, but they wouldn't be, if their main purpose is to produce tobacco products, they would lose most of their economic value. Okay, here's the kicker. Let's see, can I highlight on here? Let's see, there's a pencil. See if I can do this. So here's the main point. This apparently very complex phenomenon is explained by the fact that all of the goods enumerated above derive their goods character from their causal connection with the satisfaction of the human need for tobacco. With the disappearance of this need, one of the foundations underlying their goods character is destroyed. Danny, how do I erase? Sorry, what I should have done is... Okay, what I should have done is, sorry guys, just getting used to the technology here. And there's a pointer, but really what I wanted to do was this. How about that? Okay, that's even sloppier than what I was doing before. Anyway, the point is, it's this idea here of the causal connection. That's the key, right? I don't know if Bob used this term, but we sometimes use the term causal realist to describe Austrian price theory and production theory, right? So Menger's approach is causal because it's based on cause and effect. It's also realist or realistic, right? Because it's aimed at explaining, you know, prices and quantities of real economic goods and services, not hypothetical, you know, mathematical quantities and things. Remember, I always remind my Austrian students, if anybody knows, does anybody know what Menger's profession was before he became an economist? Before Menger became a professor, before he wrote his Principles of Economics, became a professor, does anybody know what Menger did for a living? 50 bonus points on the final exam if you know this. No Googling. Hey, no fair. Somebody who's at Mises U already heard this. Okay, so Jock, tell everybody what it was. That's right, financial journalist. Menger was basically a newspaper reporter, right? I mean, he was the financial market guy. He studied the market. He reported on prices and market movements and so on. So Menger was never interested in developing an airy-fairy, hypothetical, stylized, abstract mathematical representation of things. Right? Menger certainly does use abstraction and derive general principles, but these are principles for explaining real economic phenomena. Okay, so what we have here in this quote from Menger is the idea that there is a causal connection between the value of consumer goods and the value of those factors that are used to produce consumer goods. Okay, that's the key, that's the basic intuition behind the Austrian theory of imputation. Okay, Menger goes on, he says, this is the, he calls it the general law of the determination of the value of a concrete quantity of a good of a higher order. Okay, this idea of a concrete quantity is important too. This is part of Menger's causal realism, right? The idea is not to explain the value of tobacco labor in general, the tobacco labor force as some kind of abstract thing. No, Menger is talking about explaining the prices in the market for specific, discrete, tradable units of goods and services, right? One cigarette rolling machine, so many pounds of tobacco, so many hours worth of a specialized tobacco worker's labor. Okay, so we're interested in determining the value of concrete quantities of higher order goods, not consumer goods, but factors. Assuming in each instance that all available goods of higher orders are employed in the most economic fashion. Okay, so assume that all of these higher order goods are deployed to the areas in which they can create the most value for the consumer. The value of a concrete quantity of a good of higher order is equal to the difference in importance between the satisfactions that can be attained when we have command of the given quantity of good of higher order, whose value we wish to determine, and the satisfactions that would be attained if we did not have this quantity at our command. This law corresponds exactly to the general law of value determination. Now, what is the general law of value determination? This is the great insight that is developed in Menger's principles for how we as consumers value goods and services. The Austrian concept of marginal utility. Like, you know, here's, I've got some water here for my lecture. Right? Some of you may be familiar with this kind of illustration before, right? If I only have, you know, imagine a stock of glasses of water. Actually, I have two of them here because I get thirsty when I'm pontificating. You know, if I only had one glass of water, what would I do with it? Well, Menger says, imagine that you could rank order a set of wants or needs, desires, right? And you can rank them from most important to least important. So, you know, drinking water is the most important thing because we need water to survive and so on. If I only have one glass of water to my name, I'll drink it. Right? What if I have two glasses of water? Well, I'll drink the first and I will use the second to satisfy a less urgent need, maybe using it for cooking. Right? If I have three units of water, I'll drink the first, cook with the second, and bathe with the third, right? If I have a fourth unit of water, I'll cook with the first, drink the first, cook with the second, bathe with the third, and with the fourth, I'll water the plants or something, right? And so on and so forth. And each person's ranking is subjective, and it's up to that person's preferences. You know, I mean, for Bob Murphy, bathing would be much farther down the list than it would be for me. The point is, according to Menger, you know, you can turn that around. If you have five units of water and then you lose one, right, then you lose that fifth, you can no longer satisfy that fifth want. So the value of a fifth unit of water is the difference between how satisfied you are when you only can satisfy your first four needs and how satisfied you are when you can satisfy all five. Right, so the value of a marginal unit of water is equal to the loss in satisfaction from the need, no longer being able to satisfy the need that unit of water was allocated for. Okay, the point I'm making is that when you move on up to the higher order goods, to the production process, Menger says the principle is exactly the same. Right, in other words, what's the value of a particular cigarette rolling machine? Well, we say, you know, to what extent can we satisfy consumer wants from consuming tobacco if we have that tobacco rolling machine plus all the other ones that we have? If we then take away that one, if we lose one tobacco rolling machine, we can produce less tobacco, And some consumer wants that previously could have been satisfied with the additional tobacco now can't be, right? So the value, the precise way to determine the value of that machine on the margin is what is the value of consumer goods and services lost if we no longer had that particular machine. Okay, so there's kind of a principle of diminishing marginal value here, just as there is for diminishing marginal utility. Right, the value of the fifth unit of water, in my water glass example, is lower than the value of the fourth. The value of the fourth is lower than the value of the third, and so on. Notice there's no cardinal utility here. We're not violating any assumptions of subjectivism. We're simply saying that the fifth unit of water is allocated to a lower valued use than the fourth unit of water. Otherwise, we wouldn't have allocated them that way, right? Likewise, the fifth cigarette rolling machine is allocated to a lower valued use than the fourth cigarette rolling machine, because the fifth machine is producing additional units of tobacco that we wouldn't have if we only had four machines. Okay, so if we only had one cigarette making machine, we use it to produce tobacco for our highest valued tobacco uses. When we add a second machine, the tobacco that it produces is allocated to lower valued uses, and so on and so forth. Okay, so you can see a great symmetry here between Menger's treatment of consumption and his treatment of production. Okay, so back to the story. Remember that one of the key characteristics of this Austrian notion of imputation is that, you know, we're trying to explain the pricing of unit factor services. In other words, the services produced by a specific discrete quantity of a factor unit. Now, how we define and measure the units depends on the industry, depends on the conditions. The units could be cigarette rolling machines. They could be hours of labor dedicated to production of cigarettes. It could be amounts of land or quantities of tobacco seed, weights of tobacco seed, whatever. Okay, but we're interested in pricing units of higher order goods. Okay, now note that where a particular physical good or service fits in the structure of production is not objectively given, but that's subjectively determined by entrepreneurs. Right? Take bread, for example. Is bread a final good? Well, if I want to just eat a piece of bread, if I have a piece of bread right here, a hunk of bread, and I want to eat it, then for me, that bread is a final good. It's a consumer good. Right, and flour is a higher order good, and wheat is a higher order good above that, and so on. But what if what I really want to consume is toast, okay, or maybe croutons? Do you guys ever make your own croutons? You're supposed to have sliced bread and leave it out. You leave it out and let it go a little bit stale, and then you toast it and you make croutons out of it. If croutons is what I want to consume, then bread is an input into the production of croutons, right? If I'm a restaurant selling restaurant meals, then the good or service being sold to the consumer is a Caesar salad, and croutons are one ingredient in a Caesar salad. Then bread is an input into the production of croutons, and croutons are an input into the production of Caesar salads, which I then sell to consumers, right? Notice that In these examples, the physical characteristics of the bread haven't changed. It's the same bread, but whether it's a final good or a just once removed from production, final good, intermediate good, or a two steps removed from final good, intermediate good, totally depends on the plans and beliefs and objectives of the individuals involved. Okay. Now, whenever we think about imputation, it seems obvious to contrast it with other principles of explaining how intermediate goods are used and how they're priced and so on. Obvious one that comes to mind is something like the labor theory of value that was favored by the classical economists, Smith and Ricardo and Mill and so on, and to some extent adopted by Karl Marx. Right? So there's a whole family of cost of production theories of value in which the prices of consumer goods on the market are determined by the cost of the materials that go into producing them. Okay, I'll come back in just a moment with an example that helps us to see the fallacy of cost of production theories of value. In kind of mainstream neoclassical economics, you have sort of it's kind of a weird hybrid with a little bit of subjective valuation, a little bit of objective cost principles mixed together. But there are a number of characteristics that are critical to the sort of so-called mainstream neoclassical approach to production of the firm. Assumption of variable proportions among inputs, assumptions that firms maximize kind of a mathematical profit function, that they minimize costs as given by a particular equation, that factor markets are perfectly competitive, and so on. And we're going to drop, Austrian production theory doesn't require those kinds of assumptions. Why is this important? Well, I want you to remember that one of the great contributions of Austrian economics is Mises' theory of the impossibility of rational economic planning under socialism. The contribution that led to the so-called socialist calculation debate. Some of you may have studied this before. If you have, you will recall that Mises' basic story as to why economic calculation was impossible under socialism has to do with factor markets. Right? Mises' story is in a socialist economy without private ownership of the means of production, factors, resources, there can be no markets, no exchange markets for factors of production. If the government owns all the land, the government owns all the steel, the government controls all the labor, and so on, then there are no land markets, no steel markets, no labor markets, and therefore no prices for factors of production. There's no price of a particular piece of land, type of land. There's no market price for steel. Therefore, when the socialist dictator, the central planner, is trying to decide how to allocate resources to various production needs, there is no way to know what's the most efficient way to do it, right? If the dictator wants to build a railroad, he has no way of knowing if it's more efficient to use steel to make the tracks or to use aluminum or tin or gold or platinum or titanium or concrete or paper mache or whatever, right? Because even if the dictator knows kind of the technical engineering properties of those materials, even if the dictator knows what quantities of steel and what quantities of aluminum and so on you need to be able to make a railroad track that works, without prices, the dictator has no way of knowing what's the most cost-effective way to do it, right? There's no way to know if railroad tracks is a good use for platinum or if platinum would be more highly valued elsewhere in the economy, because there are no prices for platinum and no prices for steel. So the dictator is literally, the term Mises uses, groping in the dark. It's just basically guessing about what factors to use, how to combine factors in different ways, which factors are best, how to allocate factors to various final goods and services. The dictator has no way of doing this rationally, of allocating resources to their highest value uses. Remember, that's critical. That is essentially why Mises says socialism doesn't work, because there are no factor markets and no factor prices. Now, the reason that neoclassical economists don't buy Mises' thesis about socialist economic planning is because they have a completely different understanding of factor markets. They don't think you need real factor markets to price factors. You can do a mathematical model or simulation or a set of simultaneous equations that is just as good as the real factor pricing process. Very insightful or illuminating quote in this regard is in Joseph Schumpeter's great book, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. Schumpeter was trained in the Austrian tradition, at least in part, and was a contemporary of Mises, sort of a rival to Mises, in fact. Schumpeter, discussing socialism, he mentions Mises' point and says, well, of course Mises was wrong because we can build formal mathematical models of the pricing process, and we can perform imputation You know, we can do imputation with a set of equations. Schumpeter says, the feasibility of economic calculation under socialism, what Mises denied was feasible, this feasibility follows, quote, from the elementary proposition that consumers in evaluating or demanding consumer goods, ipso facto, also evaluate the means of production, which enter into the production of those goods. So Schumpeter is recognizing that the values of factors are determined by the decisions of consumers, the subjective valuations of consumers. But he adds this ipso facto part. You know, as a matter of fact, when consumers subjectively value consumer goods, they are automatically, instantaneously, magically assigning values or prices to the factors at the same time. Almost as if it just happens poof by magic, right? So Mises would agree with every part of this statement except the ipso facto part. In other words, imputation for Mises, it isn't automatic. It doesn't happen by magic. It can't be estimated or simulated by government planners with computers or with formal models. No, this is what the real market process does. The evaluation of higher order goods based on consumer valuation, that's what entrepreneurs do. You need the real, robust entrepreneurial market process to have imputation take place. So Schumpeter's problem in this sense is that he did not assign any role to the entrepreneur in the imputation process. Schumpeter, of course, did have a theory of entrepreneurship, but he defined the entrepreneur in a totally different way than Mises. His entrepreneur performs another role, sort of an innovation role, but Schumpeter did not give the entrepreneur any role in the mundane, day-to-day, ordinary process of value and factors of production. Whereas for Mises, that is exactly what the entrepreneur does. That is the main role of the entrepreneur. That's the glory of entrepreneurship, is that it assigns prices to factors of production. Okay? So what exactly, with that background, what does Rothbard do in Chapter 7? Well, some elements of his theory that will be familiar to those of you who have studied mainstream neoclassical production theory is, the definitions of inputs and outputs, right? So Rothbard does have land, labor, and capital goods as inputs into the production process, and consumer goods coming out, outputs. The concept of profit and the parallel concept of loss figures prominently in Rothbard's analysis, but there's some things about it that are different. And again, if you've been through a mainstream micro course, there are things about Rothbard's approach that will strike you as very strange. Most obvious is it doesn't look the same. There are no cost curves. Okay, there are no cost curves whatsoever in Rothbard's analysis. He does have a few graphs. He has these average product and marginal product graphs, so he does have some illustrations dealing with the sort of physical aspects of production. But he doesn't have any cost curves. You guys know what I'm talking about? The diagram that dominates, the standard, I can't really draw this, the standard textbook accounts, price and quantity and a marginal cost curve and an average total cost curve. Average total cost and, maybe a horizontal demand curve if it's perfect competition. Some of you know the sorts of pictures that I'm talking about. That's completely absent from Rothbard's treatment, even though some version of that diagram is what dominates all of the mainstream treatments of production theory. Rothbard's is an economic, by which I mean causal realist, not a technological explanation. I mean, he does talk about technological issues, how much steel you need to mix with how much, labor or whatever. But Rothbard is always emphasizing the economic aspects, not the engineering aspects, okay? So there's an emphasis on means and ends, which, of course, implies time and uncertainty. There's no assumptions about perfect competition in factor markets. Rothbard is analyzing real-world factor markets, not stylized, hypothetical, imaginary factor markets. Rothbard places this emphasis on factor specificity, on factors that are differences between specific factors and general purpose factors, which is important. In the mainstream treatment, there's almost no discussion of specificity whatsoever. The emphasis in the textbook treatments is all on variability, whether factors can be used in variable proportions or in fixed proportions, an issue that is only ancillary in Rothbard's treatment. And again, as I mentioned before, like Menger, right, Rothbard is interested in explaining real world, the prices of real world discrete factors, so many units of labor, so many units of a particular capital good, and so on, not these sort of aggregate categories of capital and labor. This is not a class theory where, you know, labor has its economic interest and capital has its economic interest, and, you know, never the twain shall meet. There's nothing like that. And, of course, the entrepreneur plays a very central role. Okay? Now, the sort of the mechanics of Rothbard's treatment is that he introduces the or uses the concept of marginal value product. Now, somebody asked in the Q&A ahead of time, why does Rothbard use the term marginal value product instead of marginal revenue product, which is the more modern term? The answer is, I have no idea. They're, as far as the treatment is concerned, they're perfect synonyms. So what Rothbard calls marginal value product, you can call marginal revenue product, if you like. The idea of discounting here is important, too, right? So the factors of the prices of factors will, in certain cases, with some caveats, will be determined by their discounted marginal value products or marginal revenue products. Okay, so for the moment, let's drop the assumption that some factors are purely specific to particular production processes, right, and assume that we have at least some factors that can be used in multiple production processes. Right, so you might have a machine, that cigarette rolling machine that is can only be used to roll cigarettes and nothing else. And then you have a worker who is employed at a tobacco factory. Well, that worker may have a lot of advanced training in making cigarettes, but, you know, presumably with a little bit of retraining can learn to do something else. And maybe if it's the janitor at the cigarette factory, presumably with almost no retraining, he could be a janitor in some other production process. Right, so some labor is specialized, but some labor is pretty generic. Right, so assume that we have at least some factors that can be substituted across multiple lines of production. So the definition of DMVP or DMRP, it's the money revenue attributed or imputed to one service unit of a factor discounted by the social rate of time preference. In other words, discounted by the pure rate of interest. Let's break this down. What do we mean by the money revenue attributed to one service unit of a factor? Well, if that factor is labor, right? Suppose that I'm operating a cigarette factory and I can hire Bob Murphy to be, let's make him the janitor, let's say, to be the janitor in my factory, and having a good janitor helps. It helps to, you know, the place is cleaner and the workers are happier, the skilled workers are happier, and we can produce more tobacco. Right, so assume that if I have no Bob Murphy, right, my factory produces, you know, $1,000 worth of tobacco in a day. If I add Bob Murphy to the mix, and now I have him cleaning and carrying things and helping out around the factory, then I can produce, you know, $1,050 worth of tobacco. So how much additional revenue do I earn from adding one day's worth of Bob Murphy's labor? In that example, it would be $50, right? So a day worth of Murphy labor is worth, to me, the entrepreneur who runs the cigarette factory, $50. So if we assume that the service unit here is days of labor, then one unit of Murphy is equal to $50. Okay, it's worth $50. I know, obviously, that's a highly fanciful example because there's no way Murphy could possibly be worth $50 for a day's worth of his labor, right? So $50 would then be the undiscounted marginal revenue product, right? So hey, what's Murphy doing on this conference call? Get it, log him off of here. So 50 would be the MVP or MRP. So without taking discounting into account, one unit of Murphy's labor is worth that $50. But let's assume that, you know, I pay Murphy at the end of every day, right? I give him his payment at the end of the day, but I don't actually get the revenue that he's generated for me until the cigarettes are sold on the market, right? So I go ahead and pay Bob his $50, but then there's, you know, a two-week delay before the cigarettes actually make it to the tobacco store and I get some revenues, right? So the reason we want to discount the $50 is to say, look, one unit of Bob's labor generates output that will give me $50 2 weeks from now. Okay, so this is a time discounting question. What's the value of $50 given to me in 2 weeks? Well, it's going to be something less than $50. The present value of Murphy's revenue when I actually get it is going to be lower today because I have to wait 2 weeks before I actually get before I get that money. So, you know, let's say that I'm only willing to pay him $49. I discount the value of his labor by a dollar because I have to wait before I get the revenues. So in my example, the MRP of a day of Murphy is 50, but the DMRP is only 49. Okay. Now exactly what that discounted marginal revenue product is depends on the appropriate discount rate. Okay. So put it another way. Suppose that Murphy comes to me and asks for a job, right? He says, hey, I want to, please hire me to sweep up. I'm a very good janitor. I can get your floors sparkling clean. And I say, well, you know, do I really want to hire this guy? You know, how much would I be willing to pay for Murphy's services? Well, if I could, let's say that he and I agreed that he would work for me for $40 a day. Okay, and suppose that I've estimated that the DMRP of that day's worth of his labor is $49. Now, if I can hire him for $40 a day, then each day he's generating $49 worth of additional value for me. If I only have to pay him $40, well, then I'm earning $9 of profit. I'm earning a pure entrepreneurial profit of $9 from the fact that I can, you know, I can get him for less than his actual DMRP. Okay, so you know, if Murphy says, "Hey, I'll work for you for $40," I'd say, "Sure, come on, you know, let me sign you up." If Murphy says, "Well, I'll work for you for $45 a day," well, okay, then I'm not quite as happy, right? Because then I only earn $4 of profit per day, but at least I earn some profit. So I'd say, "Okay, sure, I'd rather hire you for $40, but if I have to pay $45, I'll pay $45." Now, what if Murphy says, I'll only do it for $60? You know, my minimum price to be willing to sweep your floors is $60 a day. I'd say, I'm sorry, Bob, I can't do that because you are only worth $49 a day to me. I won't pay a penny more than $49. I'd like to pay $20, but I'm willing to pay up to but not beyond $49 a day, or maybe $48.99 if I want to have at least one penny of profit. Now, as somebody is pointing out in the chat window, right? So now imagine there are lots of entrepreneurs competing for the services of Bob Murphy, right? If I'm hiring him for $40, but let's assume that he also has a discounted marginal revenue product of $49 for my competitor. Right? My competitor says, oh, well, if he's working at clients paying him $40, you know, I'll go to him and say, hey, come work for me. I'll pay you $41. And that's still a good deal for him. And then somebody else comes and bids Bob away at $42 and so on. But if there is competitive bidding among entrepreneurs, then the price of Bob's labor will be bid up to something close to or almost equal to his discounted marginal revenue product of $49 a day. Okay? Just a couple of footnotes here, a couple of things to notice here, right? Is Bob Murphy's labor an economic good? Yes, because it is something that can be used to satisfy consumer wants. Is it a consumer good? No, it's not, right? Because remember, the buyer of Bob Murphy's labor is me, the entrepreneur. Why am I willing to do it? well, you know, my willingness to buy a Caesar salad and eat it is determined by the direct satisfaction I get from consuming the Caesar salad. So my willingness to pay for a Caesar salad depends on how much I enjoy, you know, eating a Caesar salad. As an entrepreneur, my willingness to pay for Bob Murphy's labor is not determined by the subjective utility I get from being around Bob Murphy. I mean, if you spend as much time around Bob Murphy as I have, you'd know that that's a pretty low number, right? It's not that I get a warm, fuzzy feeling every time he passes by with his broom, right? The only reason I'm willing to pay money for Bob Murphy's labor is because I can use Bob Murphy's labor to make something that I can sell to somebody else and get money, right? I want the money from selling the cigarettes. So the only reason I have a desire to pay for Bob Murphy's labor is because that is an input into something else that I can sell and make, you know, and make some money from selling. So that's point number one. That's where imputation, right, is coming into the story. You know, also point number two, just realizing that in a competitive market for labor services, the prices paid to labor, i.e. the wages, the wage rates that workers earn, the salaries that workers are paid, is determined by their value in production. Okay? You know, why do professional athletes and, you know, entertainers make, you know, millions of dollars and lowly economics professors like me make somewhat less than that? Right? Is it because of exploitation? Is it because society is evil? Is it because we're underappreciated? Is it because of market failure? No, it's because the value, the MRP, the DMRP of, I can't think of anybody, Usher. Yeah, isn't he a professional singer? The DMRP of Usher is way higher than the DMRP of Peter Klein. Okay, it has nothing to do with intrinsic worth or moral worth, right? I could say, well, I don't want my kids listening to that trash, hip-hop, R&B, rap. It's just garbage. It's not Mozart. It's not Beethoven. Or it's not, you know, what I think is the highest form of music, like The Clash, Sex Pistols, Dead Kennedys. It's not high-quality music like that. But for whatever reason, the market really desires that stuff, and the market doesn't desire my stuff. Okay, so the market value of Usher's labor is much higher than the market value of my labor. Notice also there's some implication here about, you know, things like discrimination. Suppose that there is, Bob Murphy, as I'm sure you all know, is of Irish descent, right? Suppose that I, as the cigarette entrepreneur, am prejudiced against the Irish. Right, suppose I refuse to hire Irish, and of course this is true in cities like Boston in the 19th century. There was a lot of prejudice against the Irish. Suppose that I'm a bigoted factory owner who refuses to hire Irish. You know, Murphy really can produce, you know, he really does have a DMRP of $49. I really would be adding to my revenues $50 minus a little discount if I were to hire him, but because I'm prejudiced against the Irish, I refuse to hire him. Does that mean that poor Bob Murphy is, you know, sort of out of luck and unable to get a job? Well, if every potential employer of Murphy's labor is an anti-Irish bigot, then yeah, maybe Murphy's out of luck. But notice that it only takes one shrewd entrepreneur who may be a bigot, may not like Irish people, but likes money, right? He may not like the green shamrock of the Irish, but he likes the green of his dollars. And he says, look, I don't really like these Irish guys, but, I mean, nobody else will hire this guy at all. And, you know, welfare pays him $20 a day. I can just pay him $21. He'll come work for me, and I'll get a huge profit. You know, he's worth $49 to me. I can pay him $21. That's enough to make him come to work, and I get a huge profit from that, right? It only takes one other entrepreneur who is either not bigoted at all or willing to see through his bigotry to earn money to bid that price up and so on, right? So it shouldn't be the case in the market that certain groups of people, certain types of people are systematically paid less than what they are worth, because then that represents a profit opportunity for an entrepreneur who's willing to see through the bigotry or overcome the bigotry or who is not bigoted at all and we'll pay this person closer to what they're worth. And then their wages would eventually be bid up to the DMRPs as well. Okay? So our point is, just to recap here, the DMRP establishes the entrepreneur's maximum willingness to pay for a service unit of the factor. And if there is competitive bidding by entrepreneurs in what Rothbard calls the evenly rotating economy, which I assume you guys have talked about already, kind of this long-run equilibrium state, a factor prices will exactly equal their DMVPs in Rothbard's terminology. With certain caveats, there is the requirement that the factor be what Rothbard calls isolable. And that's a term you may not have encountered before. What Rothbard means by isolable is that the marginal contribution of this factor can be isolated from the marginal contributions of other factors, right? So suppose that Bob Murphy has a unique kind of a broom that he uses when he sweeps up. And there's only one broom like this, and Bob's the only one who can use this broom. Nobody else can use it. Without the broom, Bob can't do anything, and nobody else can be very effective with this particular broom. But then I can say, well, Bob and his broom generates, let's say, $49 of DMVP or DMRP for me. But if Bob doesn't have his broom, he's not worth anything. He's worth nothing to me without his broom. Likewise, just having the broom isn't worth anything to me at all. So as an entrepreneur, I cannot, in that case, assign a DMVP or a DMRP just to Bob, nor can I assign a DMVP or a DMRP just to the broom. I can only assign a value to the package, Bob plus a broom. Right? So in a case like that, Bob's labor, the contribution of Bob's labor cannot be isolated from the contribution of the broom's labor. Okay, so that's what Rothbard means by a factor having to be isolable. So there has to be some variability. In other words, it can't be you need one Bob and one broom. You have to, whereas one Bob and half a broom wouldn't be good at all. Right? You have to have some ability to substitute these factors in different combinations. And also, you can't have any factors that can only be used for this specific production process. So as long as the factors can be used in variable proportions and they are not completely specific, then you can isolate the contribution on the margin of a particular unit of a factor. Okay? Here's some examples, right? Suppose you have non-specific factors that are used in variable proportions. So, some labor and some raw materials and machines and so on, they're not specific to this production process, and you can vary the proportions and get a little bit more output, right? So, let's say if you have four units of A, where's my pointer? There's three factors A, B, and C. Let's suppose that four units of A, 10 units of B, and C, 2 units of C together produce stuff you can sell in the market for $100. Right, but if you were to take away one unit of A, this is Menger's idea, right? If you still have your 10 units of B and your two units of C, but you take away a unit of A, you can only produce stuff that's worth $80 on the market. Then the marginal revenue product, or in Rothbard's term, the marginal value product of that one marginal unit of A is $20. Right? So if forget about discounting for a minute, if there's no time preference and there's competitive bidding among entrepreneurs, then the price of that unit of the factor A will be $20. Okay? Notice, we're talking marginal here. We're not saying, what is the overall intrinsic value of A? Right? We're not saying that. We're saying, what is the value of this specific unit of A, the fourth unit of A? Right? So just as with Menger's consumer goods, it's what's the value of the first unit of water, the second unit of water, the third unit of water. Notice that the ordinality is the same thing here. We're saying the price of a fourth unit of A, given how many units of A are in existence and the other possible uses of A and so on, is $20. Oh, whoops. Oh, I didn't know you could do that. Hey, look at that. Whee! Okay, I learned a new trick here. Okay, how do I erase it? How do I get rid of it? Ooh, wow, I can do that too. Laser pointer. Okay, let's, I don't know what I'm doing here, but let's stick with the laser pointer. Okay. Ooh, sorry, there's, looks like there's a little bit of a formatting error here. This should be flush left over here. But what if you have non-specific factors that are used in fixed proportions, right? In other words, suppose that this is like Bob and his broom. So suppose that I start out with 4A, 10B, and 2C, just as I had before, producing $100 worth of stuff. But if I have, if I take away one of my units of A, in other words, I have 25% less A, then I also only can use 25, I also use 25% less B and 25% less C. Right, you know, like a recipe, you're making bread, right? You know, you have so much flour and so much yeast and so much water and so on. You know, you can't use 25% less water and get, you know, exactly the same quality of bread, just a smaller quantity. No, it won't, I mean, the proportions have to be right or the bread won't work. It'll be flat or it won't rise or it'll be too mushy or too dry or something like that. So imagine that you have to use the factors in particular specified proportions. Well, in this case, if I use less A, I also have to use less B and less C, and so then I only get stuff that's worth $75. Right, so notice in the second case here, the marginal revenue product of A is higher. It's $25 instead of only $20, right? Because, look, whenever I vary my units of A, I'm also varying my units of B and C in these fixed proportions. So a marginal unit of A is going to be more valuable to me in this case than it will be in a case where I can just vary A by itself and I don't have to worry about changing the quantities of the other factors, right? So here the marginal revenue product is 25 and the price in the market can be no more than $25. Okay, here's a weird case. What if you have a so-called indispensable factor, a factor that whose contribution cannot be isolated from the value of its complementary factors? In other words, suppose, you know, one unit of A, two units of B, three units of C make stuff that's worth $200. But if you take away a unit of A, you can't produce anything, right? So A is Bob Murphy, and, you know, B and C are his tools, his broom and his dustpan and other tools that Bob Murphy uses. And, you know, Bob is the only one in the world who can use these tools. If we take away Bob, it doesn't matter that we still have two brooms and three dustpans sitting around. Nobody else can use them, so the value of those tools is zero, right? So when we have Bob and two brooms and three dustpans, we can produce $200 worth of stuff. Without Bob, two brooms and three dustpans, we can produce $0 worth of stuff. So the marginal revenue product of a unit of Bob, in this case, is $200. Okay? And his price on the market will be, can be bid up to $200. It won't be more than $200, but it could be as much as $200. Right? So this is kind of a weird case where you have one factor that is indispensable. If you don't have that one factor, you got nothing. Right? So, I mean, what would be a real example in labor markets? Well, there are factors that are almost indispensable. You know, how about Steve Jobs and Apple? Every time Steve Jobs announces another health issue, look what happens to the price of Apple stock, right? Or like, you know, trying to make a Star Wars movie without George Lucas. Without George Lucas, there isn't a Star Wars movie, okay? There are some factors that can, you know, that are indispensable to a particular production process. One thing this suggests is that, you know, it isn't necessarily the case that you can add up the prices of the factors and get the price of the final good. This was something that the early Austrians in developing the theory of imputation worried about. Wieser in particular, the so-called adding up problem. But, you know, look at this in this case of the indispensable factor, right? If the marginal value product or marginal revenue product of unit A is $200, then, you know, but that's equal to the value of the whole final output. right? So, you know, as long as factors B and C also have a positive marginal valuation, if they're also indispensable, then the two units of B you might need them to get anything, to produce anything, in which case the two units of B might be worth $200. You might have a whole bunch of factors that are indispensable to the value of producing the final good. But if you add those up, you get more dollars than the value of the good itself. Is that some kind of a contradiction? And in Rothbard's analysis, no, there's no requirement that the prices, that the values of the marginal products have to add up to the value of the final good. The economist George Riesman, who a lot of you may be familiar with Riesman's work, he offers a criticism of the Austrian theory of imputation on these grounds, claiming that marginal productivity theory cannot explain the prices of factors in these particular cases. He uses the example of a steering wheel on a car, right? Say you have a car that sells for $20,000 on the market, but you know, without a steering wheel, nobody would pay anything for the car; it'd just be scrapped. Assume it would be worth zero if you didn't have a steering wheel. Then the marginal revenue product of the steering wheel is $20,000. But Riesman points out, well, that doesn't make any sense because steering wheels are not as expensive as cars. Steering wheels are cheap. I mean, you know, the manufacturer can get one for $50 or something. So it must be that prices of factors are determined by something else other than marginal revenue product or marginal value product. But I think that the proper response to that is to point out, look, there are cases in which remember the MRP only establishes kind of an upper bound on what the price may be. Okay? What the price of the steering wheels will be depends on the other potential uses of those materials that go into a steering wheel. It's how much is it worth to an entrepreneur producing cars versus an entrepreneur producing something else, right? I mean, imagine that you were, you know, think of one of those post-apocalyptic movies. It's the end of what was the movie? What's the Mel Gibson movie, Road Warrior? You guys seen any of the Mad Max movies? If you're young listeners may not be familiar with those, but middle-aged listeners will remember Mad Max. You know, he's got to drive his car through this post-apocalyptic wilderness, and he's got to fight off all these bad guys and so on. What if there's only one car left? Or what if you have to have that car to get across the desert? And there's only one steering wheel left in the world. Well, I mean, then you would pay up to whatever you'd pay for the car to get that dang steering wheel, right? Fortunately, we live in a world where there are many competing producers of steering wheels, and the materials that are used to make steering wheels are not highly valuable in alternative uses, right? So there can be profitable deals struck between automobile manufacturers and steering wheel manufacturers with a market price that is far below the maximum willingness to pay for a steering wheel, okay, on the part of the car maker. So there's no problem here with the marginal productivity theory. It says that in, you know, where the factor is isolable, right, its price will be determined on the market by its marginal value product, marginal revenue product. In cases where the factor is not isolable, then marginal value product or marginal revenue product simply places an upper bound on the price. But the actual price will be determined by bargaining between factor owners and factor users. And in typical cases, we would expect the equilibrium price to be far below the DMRP or the DMVP. Okay? This idea that that the cost of production determines the price. Von Bawerk has a somewhat potentially misleading discussion of this, what has come to be known as Von Bawerk's law of cost, right? We already talked about the difference between the classical or Marxist notion of the relationship between cost and price and the Austrian notion, right? The Austrian notion being that price, meaning the prices of consumer goods, determine the cost of the factors of production, the cost of production, the prices of the factors. Whereas in the Marxist and classical view, it's the cost of the factors that determine the price of the product. Bombalbert points out that under particular conditions, right, the prices of reproducible goods produced under competitive conditions tend to equal their money costs of production. And if there are a lot of steering wheel manufacturers out there, the equilibrium price of a steering wheel tends to equal the prices of the materials and so on that go into making the steering wheel, right? But this doesn't mean that cost determines price, because the cost of those inputs into the steering wheel are determined by the value and their values in other uses of production. How much will consumers pay for other things that those materials could be used for? In other words, costs are always determined by consumer valuations. Now, from the business person's point of view, you say, oh, well, you know, I'm making something with paper, and these pieces of paper, you know, cost me so many dollars from the paper store, right? But those costs are ultimately determined by consumers' willingness to pay for other things that can be made with paper, or other things that are that can be made when paper is used in the production process, and so on. So it's always consumer valuation that determines cost, and never the other way around, right? So it's important to think, to keep in mind here, a distinction between what we might call sort of proximate determinants of price and ultimate determinants of price, okay? So, I mean, yeah, I mean, the businessman says, oh, you know, I got to pay so much for, here, this is an envelope, right, a letter I received in the mail, probably from my parole officer, our collection agency. You know, I want to send out these letters. It costs me, you know, 25 cents per envelope, so I'm going to have to charge at least 25 cents to sell this mailing service to my client or whatever. There, you know, and if the price of envelopes goes up, I'll have to raise my price. The price of envelopes goes down, I can cut my price, and so on. I mean, it may very well be true that the entrepreneur is taking into account the equilibrium price of paper in determining, you know, how much he has to charge for his services to make them viable. But the ultimate determinant of the cost of our entrepreneur's production is the value of the inputs in alternative uses, right? Because the price of paper on the paper market is not exogenous. It isn't set sort of magically. It's set by competitive bidding among entrepreneurs who are trying to get paper. And their willingness to pay for paper is determined by how much they can sell, what they expect to be able to sell their products with. And so it's the consumer valuations of the things made with paper that are the ultimate determinants of the price of paper. Okay, so there's a distinction between proximate determinants and ultimate determinants. Consumer valuation is always the ultimate determinant of the price of a factor. Okay? Okay, I'm sorry, I won't try to answer all the questions as we go, but we can come back to some of these at the end. Although, actually, let me just read Jot's question here. There's a point at which the cost... Okay, Jack, I'm not sure I understand your phrasing here. I mean, look the picture in my slide here, this is a picture I sometimes use this example when I'm teaching imputation in my regular classes. This is a picture of some vineyards in France, right? So these are vineyards used to produce, this is in the Champagne region of France, where they produce champagne grapes, right? So the Marxist or classical account is that, well, it's really expensive to buy this land in this part of France. And so to produce champagne, the drink, you have to buy this really expensive land, and so you have to mark up the price of the bottle. You know, the reason that champagne, you know, good champagne costs $100 or $200 a bottle is because the land used to produce the champagne grapes is very expensive land. And of course the Austrian point is to say, no, that's got it backwards. Right? The reason this land is expensive is because consumers really like the drink. They're willing to pay $200 for a bottle of that stuff. Therefore, a lot of people want to get into the business of making it, and they're bidding against each other for the services of this land, and the price of land is bid up to its DMRP. Okay? And now I actually have a few slides here on how the neoclassical economists do it, but I'm actually going to skip those because, number one, in the interest of time, and because I don't know how many of you are really all that interested. Rothbard has a discussion of the productivity of factors. He defines the concepts of average physical product and marginal physical product. Right? And he points out that the when the marginal product is declining, when the marginal physical product is below the average physical product, the average physical product is declining. And the idea of a marginal physical product curve that has this shape, right, it's this idea that, look, when you, definition of marginal physical product is how much more stuff do you get, how much more output do you get when you add an additional unit of input, right? So how many more cigarettes do I get when I add one more cigarette machine, okay? Not how many dollars worth of cigarette value do I get, but just how many units of cigarettes do I get? So this is kind of a, engineering, industrial engineering concept, right? And Rothbard points out that in the typical case, right, as we add additional units of the factor of production, we may increase our productivity, right, because of complementarity and synergy among the units that we're using, but we eventually get to a point that unless we're also adding complementary units, additional units of complementary factors of production, the marginal physical product of a factor begins to fall, and that eventually brings down the average physical product of a factor. This has to do with the principle of, or what Rothbard calls the law of diminishing returns to a factor, right? That ultimately all factors experience this property of diminishing returns. In other words, think back to the example with the janitor Bob, right? Suppose there's a whole bunch of janitors just like Bob, potential janitors, right? Imagine that I keep adding additional janitors. So when I hire Bob, he cleans the place. It makes my other workers more productive. I can produce more cigarettes, right? Then I add a second Bob, a second person just like Bob, and now they clean together. They team clean, and maybe working as a team, they can get the factory clean even faster than they did before. And the marginal product of that second worker is even higher than the marginal product of Bob, in terms of how many more cigarettes I get. Then I add a third Bob, and a fourth Bob, and a fifth Bob, and a sixth Bob. Right? You can imagine that eventually, the Bobs start to get in each other's way. Right? If I still have the same amount of tools, the same factory size, the same amount of other workers, the same number of cigarette machines, and so on, I can't just keep adding more units of Bob and always get a proportional increase in the amount of cigarettes. Because eventually the Bobs start stepping on each other's toes, right? They get in each other's way. They become less productive, right? So that the fifth Bob is actually has a lower marginal value product than the fifth Bob. And the seventh Bob has a lower marginal product than the sixth Bob, and so on, right? So eventually you reach some point, what Rothbard's point C, where marginal physical product is at its peak, beyond which, as you add additional units of the factor, the contribution on the margin of that new unit is lower than the contribution on the margin of the previous unit. So that's this idea of diminishing returns. Eventually, the marginal physical product of a factor used in production will fall. Okay? Now, there's some further discussion in Chapter 7 that Bob will elaborate more on in Chapter 9, on differences between specific units, land, labor, and capital. Right? Well, there are some differences. Land and labor are what Rothbard calls original or primary factors, meaning factors that cannot be reproduced. There's only so much original land. There are only so many units of labor, right? Whereas capital is what we call a reproducible factor of production, meaning you can make more units of capital using the land and the labor that you have. Okay, remember that the Austrians always, when Austrians use the term capital, you can use it in two senses, right? You can think of capital meaning in the accounting sense of a sum of money. So what's the capital stock of the economy or the capital stock of a particular firm? But the Otherwise, when we use the term capital goods, we mean, you know, machines and units of labor and so on. But note that capital goods are goods and services that can be bought and sold in markets in discrete quantities and therefore can be priced. The word capital, you know, is often used in contemporary discourse in a lot of other ways, so-called human capital, social capital, knowledge capital, and so on, to refer to skills, you know, attributes, talents that people have, and so on. Those are not technically speaking capital. Human capital, you know, stuff that you learn in school, is not technically speaking capital. It's not a capital good because it can't be bought and sold in the market. Human capital doesn't have a price. Education has a price. You pay for a unit of schooling. Human labor has a price, the wage, but there's no such thing as human capital separate from labor. We can get into that more offline if you guys want. Very important the way Rothbard uses the term rent, right? So the term rent has been used in the economics jargon in different ways by different writers, different scholars, right? Alfred Marshall and David Ricardo have used the term rent. You know, when Marshall, a neoclassical economist typically following this this definition, talk about the rent to a factor, they mean the payment to a factor beyond what would be necessary to get that factor into production, right? So they talk about, Michael Jordan's a good example. Michael Jordan supposedly had a clause in his contract that the league or his team could not prevent him from playing pickup ball anytime he wanted. Right? They call that the love of the game clause. So imagine that Michael Jordan loves playing basketball so much, you know, that he would play it for free. Or, you know, with the rigors of the NBA schedule and so on, you know, he would be willing to play in the NBA for only $100,000 a year. But yet he was earning, you know, however many millions, tens of millions a year for playing basketball. Neoclassical economists would say, well, the difference between what it would have taken to get him to play, just $100,000, and what he actually earned, that extra bit is a rent. That's like extra income that you get in the theory of perfect competition that you get in the mainstream neoclassical textbooks. In equilibrium, perfectly competitive firms earn zero economic profit, so when a monopolist earns a positive economic profit, that's like a rent. That's an amount beyond what would be needed to get a firm into the market and so on. That is not the way Rothbard uses the term rent. Okay, Rothbard, following Frank Fetter, uses it in the common sense everyday meaning. When do we use the word rent? Well, I'm going to rent a movie at the movie store. I guess they don't have that anymore. I'm going to rent a car at Hertz Rent-A-Car. Or I rent an apartment, and I pay the rent every month. But rent in the everyday use of the term means payment per time period for the use of a factor. Okay, every day that you use my car, you pay me $50 in rental car fees, and you pay $500 a month to rent an apartment. Okay, so rent just means a payment to a factor service per period of time. So a wage is a rent. Bob Murphy's $50 a day is a rent, right? That's just his wage. If I rent one of my cigarette rolling machines from some company that rents these machines out, and I pay, you know, whatever, I pay $1,000 a month to rent this particular machine, well, then the rental price of that machine is the $1,000 a month that I pay. Okay, so wage payments, payments to labor, rental prices of capital goods, and rental prices of land are rents, right? So rents are determined by discounted marginal revenue products or discounted margin of value products, okay? Now, there are a few cases of capital goods where you don't, you know, in the case of machine, right, I can either rent the service of the machine or I can just buy the thing outright. Same thing with a piece of land. I can rent the use of a piece of land, or I can just buy the land myself. So in cases where the actual good can be bought and sold, the price of the whole good or service, sorry, of the entire good, the machine, the building, the piece of land, is determined by the capitalized value of the expected future stream of rents. Right? So if this machine has a DMVP of $1,000 a month, then the entrepreneur would be willing to pay $1,000 a month to rent it. But to buy it, you say, well, what's the life of the machine? I expect this machine to last 20 years. It's going to generate $1,000 a month worth of income over the life of the machine. I have to, so I calculate the present discounted value of that 20-year future stream of DMVPs, and I discount that, add it up, and discount it back to the present, and say, okay, well, then I'd be willing to pay, $20,000 for the machine or whatever it would be. So the price of a piece of land is the capitalized value of the expected future rental prices, what the landowner could get from renting out the land over the useful life of that piece of land. Now, we don't have that for labor. Right? We don't have purchase prices for labor. We only have rental prices. You don't buy a person. You just rent their services by paying them a wage or a salary. And of course, you can imagine a society with slavery, ancient Rome or something, where in that case, if you have slavery, you can buy and sell labor. Right? So the price of a slave in the Roman slave market would be determined by the present discounted value of the expected future DMVPs from the use of that slave. Okay. Rothbard also points out in this chapter a distinction between what he calls gross rents and net rents. Right. So a gross rent is how much you pay for use of that factor. So Bob Murphy's $50 per day is the rent that's a rent. The $1,000 a month that the owner of the cigarette machine gets from me, the entrepreneur, that's a rental payment for the use of that machine. But there's a difference between rental prices for labor and also for land and rental prices of machines, right? Namely, that what determines the rental price of that machine? Well, it's discounted marginal revenue product. But remember, there was land and labor that was used to produce that machine, and the value of that land and labor is determined by the discounted marginal value of the machine, right? So remember, the value of cigarettes is imputed to the price of the machine, but then the value of the machine is imputed back to the price of the machines used to make it, and so on, all the way until you get to the original factors of production, the labor and land that were used to produce the very first tool or machine that went into the production of that cigarette machine. Right, so capital goods earn gross rents, $1,000 a month for the machine, but those rents are then imputed back to the land and labor that were used to produce them. So capital goods, Rothbard points out, earn no net rents. They earn gross rents, but they don't earn net rents. Net rents are only earned by these irreproducible original or primary factors of land and labor. Okay, so in the evenly rotating economy, in Rothbard's ERE, this kind of long-run equilibrium state. Oh, whoops, sorry. I thought I had this written on another slide. In the ERE, land is earns a rental payment. We just call it rent, the rental price of land. Labor earns a rental price, the wage, right? But capital goods do not earn any net rent in the evenly rotating economy. They are paid a gross rental price. So the capital goods, the cigarette rolling machine, gets $1,000 or whatever it is. Per month. Okay, so land, labor, and capital earn rental returns in the evenly rotating economy. Now remember, there are other actors besides those who own land, labor, and capital. There are capitalists who make loans, who extend money or resources to be used in the present in exchange for payments in the future, and they earn an interest return. And can anybody guess, those of you who weren't at Mises U last week to hear me talk about this, what do entrepreneurs earn in the evenly rotating economy? Anybody know? Any guesses? Okay, so Jock is right that normally, right, in the real world, entrepreneurs have profits and losses, but exactly, in the evenly rotating economy, there is no profit or loss. There are only rental payments to factors and interest payments to capitalists. But by definition of this concept of the ERE, there's no uncertainty. Therefore, entrepreneurs can never acquire factors at prices below their DMVPs. And so entrepreneurs pay out everything they take in receipts. All of that income is imputed back to the factors, and there's nothing left over for the poor entrepreneur. Okay. I think Bob will talk about that in Chapter 8, where Rothbard introduces entrepreneurship into the analysis and distinguishes between returns to factors in the ERE and returns to factors outside the ERE, where you have the entrepreneur. Okay, so what are you supposed to take away from all this? We're out of time now. That one of the important tasks of price theory is to explain not just the prices of consumer goods, which Karl Menger does brilliantly in his principles, but also to explain the prices of intermediate goods, of factors of production. And Menger kind of hints at this, but it really isn't until Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State that we get a full, detailed, and kind of comprehensive treatment. This whole idea of studying factor pricing is not just a minor side issue. It's central to the very Austrian Misesian notion of the market. And why central planning doesn't work, according to Mises, is because under central planning there's no private property in factors, no factor pricing, and therefore none of this activity that we're talking about here that assigns cardinal numbers to specific units of factors of production, money prices, that entrepreneurs can then use in their calculations of what factors to use in what ways. Okay? And remember that the Austrian imputation view offers a challenge not only to the sort of classical and Marxist theories in which cost determines price, but even the neoclassical kind of hybrid approach in which cost is supposed to be an independent determinant of price, independent of consumer valuation. The famous two blades of Marshall's scissors, the supply and demand curves. But in the Austrian analysis, consumer valuation is the only determinant of cost. But I want you to stay tuned because there will be much more on these issues in Chapter 8 and then particularly in detail in Chapter 9. So it is 5:30. We are about out of time. And I think that I'll have an opportunity to participate on the discussion boards and maybe answer some of your questions, but I'm sure that Bob Murphy will have a lot of answers as well. Hopefully, in next week's lecture, he will not contradict everything that I've said. Maybe he'll just use different examples. It'll be the Klein janitor or even worse next week. Anyway, thanks very much to all of you for being here. It's been a lot of fun to do this guest lecture, and I look forward to seeing all of you guys somewhere down the road. Good night.